The following program has been furnished and paid for by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSCB and KGBC are not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. We'll be talking real estate, deficit, retirement, and assorted other topics. We are not going to do the cyber version today. Mr. AI Wynn was unable to join us at the last minute, but in any event, we've got plenty to talk about. I wanted to start off by reminding the listeners that just because we discuss some of these topics and you may hear content of interest, please don't rush out and attempt to deploy said comment until you've discussed it with your existing real estate, tax, legal, etc. advisors. And if you don't have any such advisors, feel free to go to our website at baplanner.com, that's baplanner.com, and complete, if you'll go to the forums link there near the top right, you can go to a page that has some intake forms on it, and the first one, step one, is a profile form. If you'll be kind enough to complete that, submit it. And if you are interested in using your retirement funds to invest in real estate private partnership syndications, as most of our clients are doing, please fill out the second step, second form as well, the retirement profile. And with that information, we'll have enough typically to tell you how or if we can work with you and help you achieve your goals and objectives. And it seems like most of the folks we work with are in one of two camps. Either they're way ahead of their retirement savings objectives and they're simply trying to find that magical mix of cash flow streams, or they're still scratching, still fighting to get enough. And of course, in today's world, with our medical advances and longer life expectancies, when's enough? And that's a different answer for everyone that asks the question. We can help you ascertain what that number is in your case. You know, if you tell us how long you're going to live and what your lifestyle is, we'll be happy to assist with those calculations. But the reality is, it's almost never enough if you've got a choice between making more money and standing still. There's too many unknowns, especially for those of you that may still be operating under the notion that pre-tax retirement savings is the better choice as opposed to the Roth tax-free. And you know, there's several different ways to get to your goal, but I would suggest to you knowing where the end line is probably the single most elusive issue we deal with. And we'll talk more about that as we pick up our Roth discussion later in the show. But in any event, I wanted to look at some news items today. We've got just an update on several issues that we track. The overdue mortgage payments currently are hitting the segment of the commercial real estate multifamily market that I have been speaking of quite a bit as of late, because I think it represents a great opportunity, and this kind of news kind of confirms that. But it's the small buildings out there that are having the problems, 2 to 4 units. Now, my focus is not necessarily 2 to 4 units, but I think you could move the line up to, say, 8 to 12, or maybe even as high as 20, and you would find that there's still a lot of properties or owners that are having some struggles. According to the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, these small properties have the highest rate of late payments to large banks, outpacing single-family homes, condos, co-ops, and townhouses. Yet, despite their ranking, the overall picture is less daunting than it seems. And I'll second that, because I can tell you there's a lot of people looking for small apartment buildings. They're in the know, and they know how attractive that asset space is. The rate of overdue payments for these multifamily homes is currently the lowest seen in over a decade. So that's the good news. The bad news is that it's still the highest rate, but it's a lot lower than it has been. In the first quarter of 2025, the share of large bank consumer mortgage balances that were overdue by 60 days or more stood at 1.55% for single-family homes, 0.73% for condos and co-ops, 0.56% for townhomes, and a whopping 2.02% for multifamily, so duplexes, triplexes, and quadplexes. Since 2013, late mortgage payments have been more common among these assets than any other category of residential real estate. The persistence of delinquencies in these markets appears to be connected to the so-called missing middle in American housing. A 2022 study published in Housing Studies found that small and medium-sized multifamily buildings, which encompass properties with 2 to 49 units. Okay, so that study in the American Studies article is more in line with what we think of as small or medium-sized. In any event, the group of 2 units to 49 units account for over 20% of the nation's housing stock. There are a lot of small apartment buildings in America. These buildings are also home to the largest share of low-income households and contain the majority of the country's rental units. Okay, so while we're on the topic, why do we like small apartments, us investors? And I've got clients that have investments in small apartments. I've got them in gigantic properties, you know, 700, 800 units, apartment buildings. And I personally have invested in as little, I still own an 8-unit in San Antonio. And I've been a partner in a large, I believe it was like 700 units in Houston. I've also invested in a portfolio along the way that I forget how many units it has, but it's 10 properties across the Southeast U.S., so it's probably somewhere in that 3,000 to 4,500 mark. And you know, the issues that have developed are not necessarily endemic to just large properties, but typically you look at your overall cost of participating as a passive investor. And I'm not just referring to, okay, if you invest $50,000, your cost being $50,000. No, what I'm looking at is what I would call the net cost, which is after the fees that the syndicator is charging has been taken out. In other words, how much money is left that's actually invested in an asset that creates value for you. And even today, after the assorted calamity that we've experienced, projects that I'm looking at still have significant fees that are being charged by the syndicator and significant sharing ratios, you know, as much as 25% being handed to the syndicator on day one. And that's in addition to 2% up to, in some cases, 3 or 4% acquisition fees, debt placement fees, capital raise fees, refinance fees, if and when that occurs. In fact, the clever syndicators are now just calling those fees capital transaction fees. So any transaction that can be construed as involving capital, which, trust me, it's pretty much everything that they might do to raise more money, even if the project gets to be in trouble, which has been the case in many cases over the last 2 or 3 years due to the rates, the interest rates, the syndicator is going to find a way to get an extra fee for handling that. And I mean, some of my clients would suggest, well, maybe the syndicator in part was responsible for putting the property in that position, or certainly failed to see what was coming in some cases. Other cases, you know, look, there's a lot of what I would call good syndicators out there that have been affected by the interest rates. They did the smart thing or the wise thing. They purchased a rate cap to cover any excess interest that might come about due to Fed Reserve rate increases up to a certain point, but no one anticipated 11 clicks on the rate increase clock. Went up 11 times over that, what, year and a half, 2 year period, and it had gone down much yet, even in spite of some encouraging data that you would think may have been grounds for lowering the rates. I know Mr. Trump sure thinks there has been, and you know, he's currently, it appears, just on the outskirts of a major tussle with the Fed board over their unwillingness to lower the rates. But that's a whole nother discussion. But bottom line is, you know, what I consistently complain about is the level of fees that are being charged that really have nothing to do with what we all signed up for. And I hearken back, you know, from a 20-year perch where up until about 5 years ago, you never saw any of these fees. The basic syndication transaction involved the syndicator getting a promote and the passive putting up money to share together in the outputs from that transaction. And now you've got all the fees, and then you further got some confusion and some, I would say, very aggressive compensation going to the syndicator that's based on having returned to you some portion of your funds, as if that's a measure to increase the compensation. That should be expected. How about we base any additional compensation on you getting us to the finish line where we've got not only our money back, but we've gotten back perhaps the equity multiple that was pro-formed, and we could use other measures, you know, math metrics or measures of performance. You know, we could look at maybe the average cash-on-cash return we received, or I hesitate to say internal rate of return. The internal rate of return is not all that transparent, depending on over what period the returns are earned. But suffice it to say, there's other ways to approach the prospect of how much success and how do we reward it. There's no question above average rates of return should be rewarded. Average rates of return or below rates of return, I'm for not just not rewarding it. I'm in the camp that would ask for some of the fees if you participate in those types of transactions. I'd like to see some clawbacks on the fees. It's like if this project wasn't as rich as you thought it was, where's the money you got paid for the acquisition fee? Why did we pay that if this wasn't supposed to be something that was at least average? And I would suggest acquisition fees have no place at all in syndication projects until the finish line has been met. And then let's talk about awarding additional fees. We're going to go ahead and circle back here momentarily after we take our first break. And we appreciate you tuning in, and we will pick up the same small apartment discussion when we return.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-782-1900. That's 713-782-1900. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com. That's Nathan at npross.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna woman up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough to take control and make the woman up and take it like a man.
Okay, welcome back to the second segment of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And we were talking in the first segment about the current mortgage delinquencies in the small apartment segment of multifamily investments and how they're the hardest hit at the current moment. 60-day average delinquency on the troubled sector, 2.02% of all mortgages, which is a lot compared to some of the other segments. For instance, condos, townhomes, single family are all significantly less as a percentage. And, you know, I started talking about, well, why small apartments at all? You know, we like small apartments. We think that's a good option right now for many people that have the foresight and maybe have a little bit of experience in investing in the larger projects, because, you know, there's such an enormous focus on fees now, you know, with these syndicators that put these deals together. And I would argue in many cases they're unwarranted. And I would also argue that the fees all seem to be a one-way street. There's never any clawbacks. I mean, first, the argument goes, you know, why the fees at all? Let's talk about that. Because I understand, and I'm going to tell you, I am all for take a position that significant fees will be allowed in a syndication. I don't care about the size, but the fees need to be an afterthought, not the reason for doing the transaction. And I am convinced, and those of you that have invested for a while now in these creatures, these private partnership syndications, I have a feeling you would agree with me that in hindsight, some of the projects that we see, both locally and nationally, it appears they may have been undertaken by the syndicators simply to generate the fees for their back pocket. I mean, why wouldn't you put a deal together to take down a 200 or 300 unit apartment building or larger? I mean, I've worked on transactions that were, you know, portfolio that had maybe 3,000, 4,000 units, you know, $75 to $100 million. Well, at 2% acquisition fees, that's a lot of money. And no clawback if the project doesn't do as intended. And, you know, you also look at the fact that it's paid before the investors are getting paid. And I get so tired of seeing, when you look at the webinars, this is all on the front end. You look at the investment summary, you look at the webinar, and you see all this language about how we put the investor first type language. That's just, I hate to say it, it's a bunch of huff. It's a bunch of sales huff. It couldn't be further from the truth. And I would suggest it is borne out by the fact that when you just look at closing, you've already got payments going to the syndicator. It's not going back to the passive investor. Are you kidding me? It's coming from the passive investor. Do you think the lender that's lending for the mortgage is going to provide extra funds to pay the fees to the sponsor to undertake that transaction? No. Without the passive, the fees won't happen, because that's where the money comes from. And that's what I was saying about the fact that a much smaller chunk of the capital that the passives are putting in is going to the actual asset acquisition that is theoretically going to perform. That's going to be the horse that's pulling the cart or that's running the race. And, you know, it's on a diet. In today's model when you look at how much money is going out to the syndicators. And I'm not saying this to you to necessarily say don't ever do it. I'm saying do it, but with tripwires that prevent you losing all of your money by not allowing all the money that's going out to fees to go out to fees. Defer the sponsor compensation to the extent it hasn't been earned. And before you sponsors or syndicators or lead partners start to tell me, well, you know, gee, I've got all these costs, start whining. Start whining about they've got all these costs that have to go to find the property. You know what? If you can't do that with your own balance sheet and your own finances, I got an idea. How about not be a syndicator? If you don't have the resources to syndicate unless you take them from the passives, don't do it. Just don't do it. And then, you know, let's let the syndicators that have been to the finish line before that have the reserves, let's let those folks be the ones that we invest with. And then, you know, let's offer them a bigger chunk of the pie at the end, the finish line, instead of at the outset, because it's just a shame what we've seen happen over the last several years where, you know, the rate changes impacted negatively and the projects, you know, many of which were foreclosed on, or the partnership gave the property back, deed in lieu of foreclosures, typically what that's called. Scanning the news, speaking of rate cuts, you know, I mentioned the just at a high level that the Trump administration has really put out with the Fed, and it's turned into a nasty spat with one of the Fed governors that I think they want to replace. And of course, they're only doing it for righteous reasons. You know, she's got it's Lisa Cook is the lady's name, and she's apparently participated in mortgage fraud by getting mortgages, more than one, that identify it was for a principal residence. I mean, this is in the space of 2 weeks, apparently, and in two different states. So it's obviously not her principal or primary. I think I heard on a Fox show earlier today that one of the applications said principal and one said primary. I'm not sure if those were check-the-box type things or if that's some indication of just how nefarious and devious that loan process was for her. But nonetheless, I believe Mr. Trump sees, hey, here's an opportunity to get a quote friendly unquote on the board that might push us closer to, you know, rates that are in line with what we think the economy is doing. But anyway, I notice let's see, today's the 31st, so 2 days ago, this would have been on Friday, one of the Fed governors, Mr. Waller, I forget his first name, but he has affirmed support for a September rate cut. So this will be interesting to see if it occurs. He was speaking at a meeting of the Miami, Economic Club of Miami, and he was saying that just in the month that had elapsed since he last spoke on the economy and monetary policy, July 17th, the economic data had reinforced his view of the outlook, and that in his judgment, the time has come to ease monetary policy and move it to a more neutral stance. Payroll reports were weak. Non-farm payroll reports were weak. He also pointed to a weakening demand in the labor market and noted that the BL BLS, or Bureau of Labor Statistics, revisions suggest the economy may have lost jobs over the past few months. But in any event, it's not a huge cut, but he's affirmed his call for a 25 basis point cut to the effective federal funds rate at the September meeting. And I know a 25 basis point cut doesn't seem like much, but that's you know, a big deal. Let's say that could get the ball starting to roll on a downhill movement easier, in other words, and it'll be interesting to see if the rest of the board goes along. I have a feeling, well, I don't think it's unknown, but I think there's going to be some resistance to rate changes just because the Fed doesn't like the attention and the attempts by the administration to short circuit or circumvent their normal processes. But in any event, let's see, I had another article that I had pulled up. You know, there's been a focus, obviously, as of late, on taxes. You know, we had the OBBBA, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, and there's now, and of course, the elderly are such a major segment of the electorate. You know, nobody wants to make the elderly angry. And I don't know what we're calling elderly. I mean, I think 65 and older. I'm in that camp now, just turned 65 a few months ago. But there is a big tax deduction increase proposed for those over age 65. Now, I don't know about you, but I look at the old BBBA as being less than what we were promised. I mean, yeah, there's a ton of tax measures, savings measures in that bill, but no tax on tips, no tax on Social Security. No, that's not what we got. We got were partial relief, but you had to meet certain criteria, and at the end of the day, it'd be like, you know, if you'd gone to Dairy Queen thinking you were getting a free large ice cream cone and you got the small one. So I'm just going to pick some pieces of this. And let's see. I haven't read it all the way through, but I'm curious if this is going to be more of, you know, over promise and under deliver. And again, I'm thankful for everything Mr. Trump has done. Just the fact that he was elected is a major win for our country compared to what coulda or woulda been. And I just, it's insane to realize just how close to disaster we came with that election. I just, you know, I marvel. And I'm going to tell you, you know, you may not believe in a providential God, but I would say that election was, you know, proof and live living color, as they say. Anyway, let's take a look at this article. Retirement is meant to be a time of ease after years of hard work. But for many older adults in America or in the U.S., taxes and rising costs make it harder to get by. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, so far this year, food prices have increased 2.5%. Rent and housing costs have climbed 4.4%. And health care services have increased by nearly 3%. Think about that. I mean, that's so far this year. So, you know, when you look at the health care cost, that ought to put us up. I mean, if it continues at the same rate, it's probably going to be between 4.5 to 5%. That's actually not as much as many years in the past. I mean, geez, I can remember not too long ago when health care costs went up 15 to 20%, just like clockwork. Every year was just expected. So that's not necessarily horrible, but it still, when you're on fixed income, as many elderly are, Social Security's the only thing they're generating income with. But in any event, as if that were not enough, those increases, speaking of Social Security, almost half of all Social Security recipients owe federal income tax on their Social Security benefits. That's a sharp rise from less than 10% back in the 80s per IRS data. I tell you what, I can see where there's going to be a bit of a discussion here. This is interesting the more I scan down this article. Let's go ahead. We're right on top of our second break. Let's go ahead and take that. And when we return, I will pick up with this article about this bipartisan proposal that maybe we can all get behind. Let's learn more. So we'll circle back here momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
People always coming up to me and asking, what's your secret? With all you do, your attitude just seems to be so good. How do you keep it? Well, I'm not the Dalai Lama, but I'll try to offer up a few words of advice. You better get to living, giving. Don't forget to throw in a little forgiving and love along the way. You better get to knowing, showing a little bit more concern about where you're going. There's a word unto the wise. You better get to living.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-782-1900. That's 713-782-1900. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com. That's Nathan at npross.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
Big dreams and faded jeans.
Okay, welcome back to the last segment of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And just before the break, we were beginning to talk about an article. This was on Kiplinger, by the way. I should have said that. And it was last updated in June. So I don't think any of these provisions made their way into the OBBBA. Maybe they did, and I should try to update that. But this is a problem. The problem that we're getting ready to discuss is one that I could say applies across the Internal Revenue Code in a way, because we've got it, and the issue is limits or thresholds are put into law when the Tax Act passes, and then they're never indexed or modified for inflation. And this happens to be, this article is going to be about Social Security, but you could say the same thing about just the whole way we measure capital gains on certain classes of assets. Take the residence that you live in. If you exceed certain thresholds, generally $250,000 if you're single, or $500,000 if you're married filing joint, of gain when you sell your property, of course you get to exempt up to $250,000 or $500,000 of gain now. But, you know, when you look at, and I know I've had clients over the years that generated some significant gains. I've got one client just here in the last year, I believe, if I recall correctly, generated a $400,000+ gain. Of course, they were still under the taxable threshold, but it could have been $600,000, okay? Maybe it was. I'd have to go back and look. It's a lot of money, but, you know, it was a scenario where they got into the game. They got onto the playing field back in the 70s, maybe late 60s, bought a little 322 single-story home, area of Houston that at that time was not in vogue. I mean, it wasn't out in the boonies, but it was, you know, not downtown, or it was not, you know, in the close-in areas. And as time progressed, all of a sudden it became in the close-in sections of Houston. I'm not going to mention the subdivision, but let's just say it was close to being inside 610 Loop. That'll give you some idea. And if you look at the gain that they will report, now whether or not it's taxable or not, I can't recall, but it could have been. Let's just stipulate to that it was taxable. What caused that gain if it was anything more than inflation? In other words, yes, there might have been some other factors that impact that gain, but why are we getting taxed on the inflation that applies to capital assets? And, you know, I know it's a little bit harder argument to make maybe if you're talking about Bitcoin or stocks or whatever, but a residence, I mean, when you look at all the new homes that are coming out or being built, how do you look at the pricing on new homes and suggest that old homes are somehow more valuable? I mean, I suppose you could argue, well, price per square foot maybe, or maybe the quality of the newer homes or the technology involved in the newer homes. But I don't understand why there hasn't been some attempt to, you know, index whatever the current regime is at any point in time. You know, now it's $250,000 and $500,000. Before, you had several options to avoid paying tax on your home, but the amounts were never indexed, or at least not to my knowledge. And this is just one facet of the Internal Revenue Code. There's others. So now let's come back to Social Security. And as you may know, if you pay Social Security, you're going to pay tax on the portion that exceeds a certain threshold. And I don't have that number. Well, maybe I do have it in front of me here. Let's see in this article. Well, in any event, we already kind of set this article up by reading the first part of it. But almost half of all Social Security, I'm going to back up to that point, as if the rising costs were not enough that we went over, almost half of all Social Security recipients owe federal income tax on their Social Security benefits. That's a sharp rise from less than 10% back in the 1980s per IRS data. The culprit? Income thresholds for taxing Social Security income have not been changed in more than 40 years, even while expenses have soared. Not only have expenses soared, but the amount of Social Security has gone up. I don't know that I would use the adjective soared, or is that a verb, maybe? And with so many retirees feeling the pinch, Congress is facing mounting calls to provide meaningful tax relief. And let me tell you, that's a call that many congressmen will pay attention to, because they increasingly, it's not just that there's more seniors on Social Security, there's more seniors on Social Security, which translates to more seniors that vote at the ballot box. So anyway, enter the bonus tax relief for America. Bonus Tax Relief for America's Seniors Act, newly proposed bipartisan legislation. If approved, the bill would more than double the additional standard deduction. Now, that's not, that's really not anything to do with the Social Security thresholds. It's just, in kind of a side door way, it would serve to offset the taxable income calculation. So it's still, I believe the way this would work is the Social Security earnings would still go into the calculation, but you would have a larger standard deduction offsetting all of your taxable income were this to occur. Its sponsors and advocates like the AARP say the legislation could go a long way to reducing the tax burden for millions of older adults. Plus, Republicans on the House Ways and Means Committee just unveiled a legislative proposal that, if passed, would also increase the standard deduction. So that part did take place in the OBBBA. And I will check when I get a chance, because, like I say, I think the OBBBA passed, I believe it was after, yeah, it was right around July 4th, if I recall. So anyway, let's keep reading. The Bonus Tax Relief for America's Seniors Act was recently introduced by a bipartisan group of lawmakers, Representatives Nicole, I'm going to take a gamble here, but Malliotakis, Republican New York, and Mike Carey, Republican Ohio, and Jimmy Panetta, Democrat California. As mentioned, the legislation would more than double the existing additional standard deduction for taxpayers age 65 and older. Currently, the extra standard deduction people over or age 65 or older stacks on top of the regular standard deduction, helping to lower taxable income. The amount of the extra standard deduction can vary based on factors like filing status and whether you or your spouse are 65 or older. Whether you or your spouse is blind is another factor. For instance, here's the numbers. For 2025, the additional standard deduction is $2,000 if you are single or file as head of household. If you're married, filing jointly or separately, the extra standard deduction is $1,600 per qualifying individual, or $3,200 for those filing jointly. The bill proposes bonus deduction amounts of more than double the current number. So the doubling was not for the total standard deduction, at least as per proposed, but the extra component is what would increase up to $5,000 for single filers, up to $10,000 for married couples filing jointly. And then, more importantly, the extra standard deduction would still be adjusted annually for inflation. The bill's sponsors say that such an increase would help offset or effectively eliminate federal income taxes on Social Security benefits for many retirees, especially those with incomes above the current tax thresholds, $25,000 for individuals, $32,000 for couples. So that's, you know, that's good news. And let's see. Okay, so here's an update to this article. It was still before the OBBBA passed. The latest, so back up to late June, the latest House GOP $4 trillion tax plan to implement Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill also includes a significant temporary boost to the standard deduction for Americans 65 and older. Under the proposal, the older adults who take the standard deductions would receive an extra $4,000, nearly doubling the current additional deduction for that age group. If approved, the bill now in the U.S. Senate has to clear several legislative hurdles. The increase would be in effect through 2028 and subject to certain income limits, of course. Here's another update. The Senate just proposed a $6,000, now this again is in June, $6,000 bonus deduction for those over 65. The move sets the U.S. Senate's proposal apart from Republicans in the House, which approved the $4,000 amount. Let's see. What about ending taxes on Social Security? That's under Trump. That's the next section of this article. And I agree. I thought that's where we were headed. In any event, let's see. In a press conference, Representative Maliotakis said the idea for the bonus tax relief bill came to her in part because her father asked her why retirees have to pay taxes on Social Security benefits. That's a good question. It's not like we didn't pay it back when, right? When we contributed it or had it extracted from our wallets, paychecks. For many years, up to 85% of a person's Social Security benefits can be taxed. To determine how much is taxable, the IRS uses, well, we've been through it. It's a tiered system. But in any event, between now and Friday's show, I will take a look at the OBBBA and see exactly where we ended up on that. But in any event, some movement's better than no movement. Okay, we're at the end of the show. Thank you for tuning in. We will return on Friday at 11 a.m. right here on KSEV. And we hope you can tune in. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.